I fully believe that even people who think they don't like to exercise, there's a form of movement out there in which they will experience not only pleasure in their bodies, but a sense of meaning and purpose and fun and celebration or competition and connection with other people. And I think most people who think that they hate all forms of exercise have probably been exposed to versions of it that actually are removed from some of the core joys that, you know, humans in our DNA are able to experience.
Hi everyone, Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. In today's episode, we're talking about the joy of movement, how exercise helps us find happiness, hope, connection, and courage. Dr. Kelly McGonigal is here to talk to us about the power of movement and how it improves every aspect of our mental health and resilience. If you're interested in this topic, if you've made a New Year's resolution to be more fit, to exercise more, to move more, this episode is for you. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep in the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, mindset, and more, all with the goal of helping you understand that your brain is not broken. I'm your host, Drew Prode, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. This week's guest is health psychologist Dr. Kelly McGonigal, whose passion is understanding the mind-body connection. Dr. McGonigal is the best-selling author of The Willpower Instinct and the Upside of Stress. Her latest book, The Joy of Movement, explores why physical exercise is a powerful antidote to the modern epidemic of depression, anxiety, and loneliness, something that I'm super passionate about. If you've been listening to this podcast, Dr. Kelly McGonigal, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start right at the beginning with this opening story that you kick off the book with, which is you say there are very few moments in your life that you can look back on certainty and say that moment changed my life. But there is a story that you do share. You were 22, a graduate student in psychology, and you were in a class. Tell us what that class was and what this moment was that you are recalling.
Yeah, so that class was called The Psychology of Shyness, which was really, it was really the probably the psychology of anxiety and social anxiety. And the main project for the course was to pick something that deeply mattered to you, but that you had been avoiding because of anxiety. And what you need to know is that I grew up doing workout videos. And as a kid and as a teenager, I had this dream of becoming an aerobics instructor. To me, that was like the ideal.
And real quick pause on
yes.
your story. Where did that even come from? Were you watching TV?
So my family are thrifters, and my mom used to get these workout videos from garage sales and thrift stores. And she always thought she was going to exercise, you know, like health kicks, and she totally did not. So we just had these stacks of workout videos, and I started doing them when I was like in third grade. And I fell in love. Like I was the kid who was what we would have then called the gym class loser. I mean, I wasn't fast. I couldn't catch balls or throw anything. I mean, I was really like kind of a clumsy, awkward kid. And yet somehow when I started to do workout videos and you had to synchronize your movement to music and to other human beings, and there was this, there's such a joy in it. And I discovered this kind of physical competence that made me feel graceful and powerful. It was like the antidote to PE class. So that's sort of how I discovered it. And of course, this was the 80s. So there also was this whole archetype of like the amazing, cool aerobics instructor. And so I sort of had that in my mind.
With Jazzercise.
Yeah, Jazzercise was actually my favorite video, in part because the instructors sing along. It's like super cheesy and amazingly fun if you're into that kind of thing. So I had that idea. And but also, you know, I was really shy. And even as a kid, I had a ton of anxiety. So I finally joined a gym as a splurge to myself the summer after I graduated college. It was like a big deal. I'm going to invest. And for 3 months, I actually took group exercise classes for the first time, like not using my VHS tapes in my little tiny studio apartment, but actually moving with other people. And I had such crushes on all my movement instructors. I was like, oh my gosh, they're amazing. And I loved the experience. So I showed up at Stanford to get a PhD in psychology. And it's still the back of my mind. I was thinking, but I really want to teach group exercise. So that summer when I was a really hard first year for me in graduate school, I actually was debating not even continuing with the program. And so I took the summer and I said, this is it, like the psychology of shyness class. We had to find this project. And I said, I'm going to get certified and I'm going to audition to teach for the Stanford aerobics program. So, you know, I spent months studying and practicing and training and taking classes. And the moment that I write about is the moment right before I auditioned. So anyone who has anxiety will probably recognize this feeling. But I was standing outside the space and I had my music with me and I, you know, I was all ready to go. I'd been practicing forever. And but my heart was pounding and I was overcome with dread and anxiety and panic. And I really wanted to go back to my dorm room and just like it never happened, like pretend this isn't real, it didn't happen. I was so overcome by panic. I thought, I can't do this. I don't want to do this. And I chose to stay, which was a really big deal because some part of me knew this was a moment that mattered. Like this was my dream. And for whatever reason, I found the courage to stay and audition. And they hired me. And I remember the first class I taught, it was a dance class. And I remember watching people move and they were smiling and I had picked just the right songs. And I literally remember saying in my head, like in words, this is what I was born to do. And so I'm so grateful to myself for staying and doing that audition, you know, because it's so sort of push and pull, like my temperament and who I am. I'm like afraid of everything. And that was a moment where I could have chosen to avoid the discomfort that I was feeling and back away from something that was scary. And I'm proud that I didn't. And I think that also was a sort of a launch point that helped me remember in future challenges in my life that when you feel that sense of, I can't do this, this is too much, to check in and see if this is something that matters. And then, you know, to trust yourself that you can find the courage you need to say yes, even when your anxious mind is telling you, run away, say no.
And sometimes that courage is mental and sometimes that courage comes from the body. Physical feeling of soothing our vagal nerve or whatever it might be, and exercise is a big part of that.
Or embracing the energy of it. I mean, that's something else that you can, so this has been a big theme in all of my work, that when you can't change the inner experience you're having, you can change your mindset about it in a way that makes it more functional. So in that moment, I could have been trying to calm down and like take deep breaths or go somewhere else in my mind. But actually what turned out to be more effective is, hey, I was about to go teach an exercise class. I need this adrenaline. This adrenaline might actually help me do better. And so rather than thinking I had to be calm in that moment, you know, you can learn what you would learn from exercise, that it's okay to have a heart pounding. It's okay to be breathing fast and deeply, that that when things are difficult, your body will give you energy. And so that's something that I learned from exercise. And it applies for lots of challenges too, not just auditioning to be an aerobics instructor.
And there's so many more layers that are in that story. We're going to come back to them. But I want to start, you know, we're recording this podcast on January 3rd. And millions of people around the world have just set a series of resolutions. And a huge percentage of those resolutions have to do with some version of exercise or fitness. And not a lot of people would use the term joy with that resolution. So what is it, big picture, that you know that you're putting joy and movement together, where a lot of people don't think of that word as being attributed to something in their life that they want to make progress on, but have not attached that word of joy?
Yeah, I fully believe that even people who think they don't like to exercise, there's a form of movement out there in which they will experience not only pleasure in their bodies, but a sense of meaning and purpose and fun and celebration or competition and connection with other people. And I think most people who think that they hate all forms of exercise have probably been exposed to versions of it that actually are removed from some of the core joys that, you know, humans in our DNA are able to experience. So the name of this book, The Joy of Movement, what I've been telling people is to think of it like the third book in a trilogy. So The Joy of Cooking and The Joy of Sex being the first two. And think about what both of those books were arguing. So The Joy of Cooking said food, nourishment, sharing meals is part of how humans literally survive. We need to eat. And it's so important to our survival that we have constructed rituals that allow us to experience deep pleasure and meaning and connection through food. So enjoy it, right? That's joy of cooking, joy of sex. Literally need it to survive. And also it's one of the core ways that human beings experience pleasure and connection with others and even meaning. So enjoy it. And what I'm saying is the same is true for movement, that human beings thrive when we move our bodies. That is core to how the human brain and body function. We need to move. And also, human beings can experience great pleasure and connection with others and meaning through movement. And so you should do it. And I'm actually arguing that movement is as central to who we are as human beings as our ability to enjoy nourishing ourselves and sex, that movement is just as important. And if people don't have that experience yet, what I'm hoping is that by encouraging people to think about what it is that make humans happy, like what are the joys that we were born to experience, whether it's something like the joy of music or the joy of mastery or the joys of belonging or the joy of being in nature, that movement actually amplifies all of those joys. And so, you know, if you have a New Year's resolution to move more and you're looking for like the easiest hack, like the shortest workout you can do in the most convenient way, you may be missing out on something that's going to be much more rewarding in the long term, which is to think, what are the core like human joys I want to experience more of in my life? And to find a form of movement that gives you access to that, because we know that physically moving your body actually allows us to access and amplifies the pleasures of all those joys that I mentioned and more.
And because words are so important, and the book is called The Joy of Movement, we have to make the distinction that there's a difference between movement and exercise.
Yeah, although I love the word exercise and I was really happy, we snuck it in the subtitle. My publisher was worried about it. They were thinking like, oh, people hate exercise, so we can't use the word exercise, it'll turn people off. But you know, the definition of exercise is, it's when people choose to move their bodies for no reason other than they want to have the experience of moving their bodies. So the only, like, the real distinction between exercise and movement is, you know, walking to work. Movement is cleaning your house. Movement is how we engage with life. Like literally picking up your child and hugging your child, that's movement. The expressions on my face right now, that's movement. And movement is what humans do. Exercise is saying, like, I'm going to take a period of time and I'm going to make movement the purpose of it without some other kind of transaction or function. So I actually, the book is mostly about exercise. It's about running or, you know, weightlifting or hiking in nature or swimming, the things that we call exercise. But what I'm hoping people will do is sort of throw out the idea that exercise is a chore and it's something that you have to endure sort of against your will, as opposed to something that is enjoyable.
Where really modern day exercise kind of comes from the calorie in, calorie out model of energy inside the body, which has obviously been proven not to be the case. Not that it doesn't matter, but obviously it's so much deeper than that.
And this is a real problem, by the way, I should say, because, I mean, people don't often like to acknowledge what you just acknowledged, so I'm glad you did it. There is this huge misconception that exercise is an ideal, perfect, controllable way to change your body, to like determine, you know, a certain kind of weight loss. And if you are not experiencing that, you're failing at exercise. I recently heard from a woman who thought she didn't deserve to spend money on something like a gym membership because she tried exercising before and she didn't lose the amount of weight that she'd been promised she would lose if she exercised. And so she thought there was something wrong and broken with her. And even though she wanted to experience, like she wanted to feel powerful and go to the gym, she thought she didn't deserve it because this whole calorie in, calorie out thing hadn't worked for her in the past. And so, you know, this whole mindset that the whole purpose of exercise is to burn calories and that like you can trust the calorie, you know, counter on a treadmill and that like that's the metric you should be observing rather than how you feel about yourself, how you feel afterward, how much energy you have, whether it's helping with your depression. I really want people to pay attention to different metrics than this sort of calorie burn.
And what could be more important of a metric to look at than how you feel, the joy that comes with it. So it's great that it's a reframe, because that negative connotation that's there in society right now also really shows you that if you are not burning out, if you're not dripping in sweat, which doesn't feel like a joyful thing all the time, if you are not completely obliterated out of workout, then you weren't really doing it right.
Yeah.
And really, this is about leaving feeling good. Not that that can't be a part of it too.
For some people, it does. I really stretch myself. I have a chapter on ultra endurance athletes, which is like the opposite of my instinct. You know, the idea that you would go out and push yourself to the limits of what a human being can do, to exhaustion and, you know, becoming physically ill and the, like, that extreme. And, you know, some people love it and they thrive on it and it is meaningful and it helps them deal with mental health challenges. So I what I want to put out is a spectrum that says you can experience a joy of movement that is relaxing, that is low intensity, that is like rolling around on the floor doing amazing yoga stretches. Like, it can be that level. It can be moderate. It can be going for a walk while you talk to a friend. Or it could be dripping with sweat, you're panting on the floor, you can't believe how hard you pushed yourself, and it's amazing what you're capable of. They can all be a form of joy, and there's no one path that you have to pursue in order to, as you put it, to like be really doing it or doing something worthwhile.
Let's start off with some of the fundamentals of movement. What's actually happening in the body? It sounds basic, but what's happening in the body when we're moving that leads to some of these benefits that we're going to be talking about later on? What's actually physically going on?
One of the neuroscientists I quote early in the book, Daniel Wolpert, he says the only reason that humans have a brain, or really that any species has a brain, is to facilitate movement. So movement is essentially the contraction of muscles to move parts of your body in a way that helps you engage with life. So I mentioned like a facial expression. Smiling is a movement that allows you to communicate with others. You know, a gesture, shaking someone's hand, reaching for a glass of water. It's a contraction of muscles that moves your body in space that allows you to engage with life. This is why movement is so central to what it means to be human. It is, there's like, other than thinking in your head, there's literally nothing that we do that's not a movement. And what's interesting is when you take that level of movement from something that is more sedentary. So if we were right now to stand up and do something even just a little bit more active, in order to give us the energy we need to do that, you'd see an increase in things like adrenaline, a little bit of an increase in cortisol to help you mobilize energy. Your blood would be, you know, filled with more energy resources to use. And your brain would give you a little hit of noradrenaline and dopamine to help you stay engaged with that activity. And that's one of the reasons why movement produces something called the feel better effect, which is when you have not been physically active, when you've been pretty sedentary, sitting or lying down, and you get up and move more of your body and your heart rate increases a little bit and you're breathing a little bit more to fuel that engagement with life. The neurochemistry of it and the biology of it, it's a little bit of a rush, and people almost always feel better immediately in like a minute or two of doing any activity. And I think that it's a funny question because you're the first person to ask me, what is movement? But if you think about movement as engaging with life, and it's sort of how your brain knows I'm engaged with life, it makes sense why so many people just going for a walk, a very short walk, will feel more optimistic. We literally sense movement as being productive. One psychologist I talked to called it the achievement sensation, that literally no matter what you do when you are physically active, the signals from your muscles and your joints and your heart that go to your brain are telling your brain, I'm doing something. And that is experienced psychologically as making progress. There's a sense of moving forward in life or having the capacity to move forward. And so at a very basic level, when you move, it's your signal that I'm engaged, that life is worth living. And then every form of movement has its own other psychological properties. And one of the things I always encourage people to do is like to think of it as a matching process, to think of it as an experiment, that if moving helps you feel engaged with life, what happens if you do something really hard? What happens if you lift something really heavy? What if you go really fast? What effect does that have psychologically, that sense of freedom that comes from being fast, from experiencing your own speed? What happens if you move with grace, like in a dance class or in yoga or qigong? What does that effect have on you when you can sense yourself having grace and flow? And there's so much more.
What's interesting, you use the word engage, because when we look at the opposite sometimes, especially when it comes to things like anxiety and depression, often words that people will use to describe how they feel is disengaged from life.
Yeah.
And I want to touch on those for a second. What does some of the research show us out there when it comes to happiness and pulling ourselves out of anxiety, pulling ourselves out of depression, making ourselves a little bit more resilient? when it comes to movement's ability to support us in that.
Yeah. So I want to preface this by saying something. Whenever I or other people start to talk about how exercise can be an antidepressant, can help with mental health, one of the very first concerns people have is that you are dismissing the value of something like medication and therapy. And so I actually want to start this because I want to talk to people who might actually benefit from movement to know that I would never argue that exercise should be a replacement for anything that works, whether it's, you know, transcranial magnetic stimulation of the brain or psychotherapy or antidepressant medication. So I'm not somebody who's gonna come out here and say, if you're depressed, you should just exercise and it's your fault if you haven't cured yourself yet, you just need to go for a run. So with that sort of caveat in place, one of the things we know is that physical activity, typically of a moderate intensity or greater, and that just means your heart rate is getting up enough that you have to breathe harder, but you're not completely out of breath, that it is as effective an antidepressant as anything else that's ever been studied, and it enhances the effectiveness of other treatments, that exercise is an effective treatment for anxiety disorders, and that people who are physically active are at less risk for things like depression and other mental health challenges. And this has been studied. If you're someone who cares about data, the data for this is as strong as you can imagine. You know, because you could say, well, of course, people who exercise more are less likely to be depressed, because when you're depressed, it's really hard to exercise. Maybe it's all correlational. But this data and these arguments come from epidemiological studies that have followed people for decades. Every country you can imagine on the planet, this has been studied. Every socioeconomic status, every age, every physical ability, anything you can imagine. Longitudinal studies, interventions where you take people who are sedentary and help them be active. Interventions where you take people who are active and you make them become sedentary and they become depressed and more anxious. I mean, if you're looking for data, this data is really secure that movement helps people either recover from or prevent or just live with mental health challenges. And it operates at so many levels, I couldn't even begin to explain. Well, I try to in the book, but sometimes I think it helps to give a few different examples of the way that this works so people can understand how deep this goes. And I'll give you two biological examples about how exercise affects the brain, which I think are absolutely phenomenal and people aren't talking about yet. So one of the most recent findings, and this is pretty innovative, only a few papers have been published on this, suggests that lactate, which is the metabolic byproduct that your muscles make when you exercise, and a lot of people blame it for muscle soreness, which is probably not true, but everyone knows, we've all heard this, like you
lactic
need to flush
acid.
That. Yeah. So research now suggests that lactate that's produced by exercise, it's in your bloodstream, it actually travels to your brain and functions as an anti-anxiety and can actually help people recover from things like trauma or depression. That lactate itself that is produced as a metabolic byproduct of exercise actually helps with brain resilience and mental health. And the reason I love that example is, like, you can't get more literal than the thing that happens because your muscles worked hard. That byproduct that we've been saying is so bad, it's like makes your muscles sore. Like that actually is like an antidepressant for your brain. And that you can produce it literally in workout one, right? Like everyone is going to produce lactate when they exercise. So that's one example. And another biological example that I love is this new insight that your muscles are like an endocrine organ. And that your muscles produce chemicals that they release into your bloodstream when you exercise that have profound effects on the brain. One of the most commonly cited examples is irisin, which can protect against neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's, that it can also protect against or help people recover from depression and trauma. And these are molecules that are literally produced by your muscles when you contract them. Any muscle contraction, that means any form of movement or exercise, is producing molecules in your bloodstream that travel to your brain, cross the blood-brain barrier, and function as an antidepressant or as a brain protectant. And the first paper that I think it was published maybe 2013 that was writing about this, the scientists were like, I think we've discovered hope molecules. This idea that your muscles are giving you an intravenous dose of hope every time you exercise. So those are two of my favorite biological examples to give, because everyone's heard of an endorphin rush. And sometimes people think when I say that exercise is good for mental health challenges, they think, oh, because you get an endorphin rush and so it makes you feel better. I'm like, no, we're talking about like profound healing molecules that you can only get from contracting your muscles and that have long-term effects at changing the function and structure of your brain.
It's so powerful when you break into it. And anybody who has experienced the joy of movement that's there also probably, I don't know if you have, I'll ask you to answer for yourself personally, they've also gone on the other side where after they've been working out or doing some sort of exercise or walking or doing something, they're like, I feel amazing. How come I haven't been doing this for a while now? And then naturally life gets busy or some sort of something happens. And then they, quote unquote, the way that I'll use a term that people use it in the general lexicon, fall off the wagon, yeah. Right? We can't talk about the joys of movement without also talking about the things and the impediments that stop people. And one of those things that you talk about is that sometimes people feel like they have to get fit to even just get back into the joy of movement.
Yeah, so a couple of things. Please remind me to jump back to some of these other things. There's so many things to address with that. And one, I'm really glad you're giving me an opportunity to mention something that's very important, which is that the joys of movement are not reserved for people who look fit, for people who are young, for people who have no physical disabilities, for people who have no physical illnesses. I made a very clear choice in this book that at least half of the studies and the stories involve people with serious physical and mental health challenges, including people who are partially paralyzed, recovering from stroke, recovering from traumatic brain injuries, dealing with suicidal thinking and severe depression, dealing with grief and loss, people of all sizes, people with Parkinson's disease, which is literally the disorder that makes it impossible to move. I went to an amazing dance class with people with Parkinson's disease. So I'm so glad that you at Juilliard too.
Yeah,
I mean,
there
are
that.
Classes all over the country, but I went to the one at Juilliard because I'd never taken a dance class at Juilliard. And there was a part of me that was like, oh my gosh, I get to go into a dance studio at Juilliard. And that's exactly like the point, that the people there felt that way too. So people coming in their wheelchairs and their walkers, but they, like me, were so excited to be taking a dance class at Juilliard in this beautiful rehearsal studio. Anyways, yeah, so we can come back to that. So you don't have to get fit to experience the joys of movement. You don't have to have a particular body size. You don't have to be free from challenges to movement. That things like feeling social connection, getting the hope molecules going, improving your mental health, feeling a sense of mastery and personal power, these have been demonstrated in any population that you can imagine, even in hospice care, where people have abandoned the goal of trying to fix their bodies or look a certain way. And, you know, I came across a number of examples of people in hospice at the end of life who are choosing to spend the time they have doing the form of exercise that they can. One of the quotes was, because that's how I know that I'm alive. And I think, like, when you get to that level and you understand that in the last moments of life that you have, that you might choose to do whatever you can physically in terms of exercise, because it's that's how you know that you're still alive, that's gonna be true for all of us. So, okay, so let's get that off the table, that you have to get fit in order to do it. But these other things that get in the way, and I say, like, there are two main things I wanna touch on. One is the excuses, and I don't mean this in a negative way. I shouldn't even say excuses, it's sort of these mental barriers we have. When you don't exercise, when you aren't active, your brain will lie to you. In a lot of my work has looked at the ways that our brain is sort of designed to give us bad signals, bad predictions about what will actually make us happy or what will actually feel good. So for example, you know, we might look at junk food and imagine it's going to be so satisfying and delicious. And the brain often lies to us about it. If you actually pay attention to your direct experience, it's often not satisfying. So with exercise, what's really interesting is there's some sort of quirk in our human biology that wants us to conserve energy. So we don't accidentally enjoy exercise so much that we run out of, you know, fuel supplies and starve to death. This sort of goes back to, like, you know, how humans survived and how we evolved having to exert ourselves in order to find food. Okay, so your brain does not want you to fall so in love with exercise that you basically can't fuel yourself enough to keep up with it. So when we're not exercising, there's this little thing we have to get over where our brain will say, why don't you just conserve that energy? Like, do you really need to do this? And we experience that often as thinking we won't enjoy the workout or thinking we're too tired and we'll be more tired if we do it. And so often there's this barrier, this inner resistance that is totally human. It's like, it's your brain is not broken. Your brain is just making sure this is really important. And if you don't actually have to move, like, maybe let's conserve that energy.
And if I could interrupt, do you think that also comes from the place too that your brain is always saying, like, I want to eat, because it's used to a fact that there's not going to be food for a little while. Yeah. So when there is food, it says go to town. So evolutionarily, you know, Dan Buettner from the Blue Zones, he says, you know, we didn't really exercise before exactly. It's just that exercise was baked into just modern day living.
So the body,
just knows that, okay, hey, I'm going to have to hunt something. I'm going to have to chase something. I'm going to have to go up a big hill. So if it's chill right now, let's just chill.
Yeah. Yes. So that's built in there. And we don't often experience it that way now. We often experience it as, I don't feel like it, or I don't have the energy for this. And when you hear that voice, you have to remind yourself not to trust it, that you have to start paying attention to your direct experience. Like, it happens to me every morning when I wake up. I try to exercise in the morning for a number of reasons, including science suggests it's really helpful for the rest of your day in terms of how you experience stress and your ability to connect with other people. It really does prime you to be a better version of yourself. So I'm not a morning person. And every morning when I wake up and I think, okay, I'm going to go exercise now, literally I think, I don't want to do this. Like me, who has written a love letter to exercise, I still think that. And I've just learned not to trust it. And I've learned to put my workout clothes out the night before to just reduce the barrier a little bit.
That's such an important reframe, because sometimes you think that the anecdote to that is that I don't have enough willpower.
Yeah.
No, or I should get over it. Or, you know, even that's a lot of the sort of, like, you know, in modern day sort of fitness, CrossFit, other stuff, not to put any sort of, it's just the tonality that often is in there in society. It's like, come on, get up, start your day, 5 a.m., whatever, 6 a.m., this, that. And if you don't have it, there's this equation of, oh, I don't have the willpower, but really it's a natural voice. Yeah. It's something that your body is designed to say, but it doesn't mean that you have to listen.
Right. And it doesn't mean that it's a useful voice. I mean, there's so many voices in the head that aren't useful. Another one, by the way, related to exercise is a lot of people have told me they don't enjoy exercise because it brings up negative thinking about their bodies and comparison to other people, or maybe even a sense of how their bodies have changed over time. Like, I used to be able to do this, but now I'm getting older, or I have injuries, and there can even be a sense of loss around that. And so one of the barriers can be, if you don't know how to work with your mind around that, sometimes exercise can feel really punitive because your mind goes to places that you really don't want to be. And so another thing that I often recommend to people is you have to put yourself in an environment where it is hard to allow yourself to fall down that thought spiral. So whether that means going in nature, where we know that nature makes it difficult to have that kind of inner thought pattern, it will just totally put your brain in a different state. Or whether it's working out with other people who are really supportive and, you know, have diverse bodies and diverse ages, so that you're not sitting there feeling like I don't belong or comparing what you look like to somebody else. Or maybe you find a trainer or a coach who is telling you how amazing you are and, you know, asking you to focus on how it feels to do a movement rather than obsessing over how that movement will change what your body looks like. And that's a really important part of finding the joy of music. Another way to do it is to get a killer playlist where people are singing things to you that make you feel powerful, badass, beautiful, optimistic, inspired. So that's, you know, for people who've had that experience, that exercise is basically a practice session of self-criticism, that doesn't have to be the case, but you sometimes have to do a little bit of a work to find the right environment.
Oh, it's so important. You know, a dear team member of mine in my company opened up and said that here in Los Angeles, in, you know, a big fitness sort of capital of the world, she was going to a Pilates class that a lot of actresses and models, and it's a very well-known Pilates class. It's a great workout, but it's also a little bit of a scene, mm-hmm. in her words. People show up with makeup and other things like that. And she was feeling that I can't work out there anymore, because even though I don't feel like I want to go in and criticize my body, I can't focus on other stuff because I'm just doing that in that environment. So she mixed up the environment and went somewhere else, which she said has been very helpful to her. And I think that's an important thing to embrace and say, okay, sometimes our mind will look for that if we're in that environment, and we can find a different situation, circumstance, to be able to still enjoy the movement, yeah. in a place that feels safe.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that I wanted to highlight in terms of a barrier, that there are things that get in the way of movement, is to acknowledge that there's certain psychological states that biologically will impair your ability to move and to derive pleasure from movement. And depression and grief are two of the big ones. And addiction can sometimes fall into this category too. And so one of the things I want to mention is that it's a paradox. So research suggests that regular activity changes the reward system of your brain in a way that is basically the opposite of the effect of grief and depression and addiction on your brain's ability to feel pleasure and to feel a sense of optimism and agency. Like, when your reward system is robust, it's easier to enjoy everyday pleasures, and you feel this kind of sense of optimism. Like, you expect that good things could happen and that you can make good things happen. And in depression and grief, and often the long-term consequences of addiction, that goes away, and it's the opposite of people's experience. And one of the side effects of that is, because your dopamine system is not functioning as well, it is literally harder to move. I mean, people who've experienced profound grief know exactly what I'm talking about. You literally can't move, and sometimes depression is like that too. And so one of the things that I want to encourage people to think about is, exercise transforms that experience, but you won't always know it in the beginning. Like, sometimes those early workouts are hell, and it is hard. It is, and you don't get the endorphin rush that people talk about, because your brain doesn't quite know how to do that yet. And some studies show that it takes about 6 weeks of regular activity for the brain's reward system to start to remodel itself and function differently, so that you get more pleasure from not only exercise, but it's physically easier to move, and it is easier to engage with life in other ways. And so I think sometimes people think like they can't start until it's easy, or if they don't get that runner's high the first time they go for a walk or go to the gym, that like they're incapable of enjoying exercise. And one of the stories in the book that, you know, really highlighted this for me was a mother who lost her son to cancer, her young son to cancer. She went into profound grief and depression, and she was literally like thinking on the couch, "I don't know if I even want to be alive." And her husband had gotten her a Fitbit, and I think her initial goal was something like 10 minutes on the elliptical. Like, she worked her way up to being able to do 10 minutes on the elliptical. And then eventually she joined a running club, and, you know, and then eventually she was doing, you know, races. But that idea that you could set the goal to work up to 10 minutes of walking or something like that, that's a legitimate goal. And it's how the process of transformation in your brain starts.
It's such a powerful example of, even something small that we can work up to is enough to get it started. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be this monumental thing. It can start off small. You know, one of the words that you talk about inside the book, which I'm very passionate about, is we are living in a world where it seems, both through national surveys and some studies that have been done out there, that the rate of loneliness is increasing. And there's so many different factors that go into that, including how we live, the role that technology plays, people's sense of isolation, families, and the way that families are living together. But what role does movement play when it comes to loneliness?
We could talk about this for hours. So once again, like with so many of these positive outcomes, like happiness or meaning, you can look at it through the biological lens and also through the basic sort of social psychological impact of movement. So let's start with the biological, because that often surprises people the most. What we know is that when people engage in physical activity, the neurochemicals that increase are bonding neurochemicals. So endocannabinoids, endorphins, and oxytocin if the intensity is high enough. All of these are brain chemicals that make it easier to connect with other people, that enhance bonding and trust, that enhance the pleasure that you get from smiles and hugs and high fives. And literally, so when you exercise, you're priming the neurochemistry of connection. And this means that you could exercise on your own and then go home to your kids or, you know, go to work, and you're going to be in a biological state that makes it easier to connect with others. And I think this is one of the reasons why you'll see studies that show on days when people exercise for the next 24 hours, they report more positive interactions with friends and family and other people. So, like, there's just the biology. But then when you add in moving with other people, we know that it strengthens relationships. So if you go for a walk with someone else and you've both got this neurochemistry going, that strengthens the relationship. If you go to an exercise class and you're working out with other people, we know that often people form very tight bonds, and that you get the sense of belonging that is fueled by that neurochemistry. But there's also the psychological aspect of it. So if you were to look at studies that try to figure out how do people know that they belong, which is really the antidote to loneliness, how do people feel valued? Where do people experience connection with others and connection to something bigger than themselves? Because loneliness is not just about feeling like I don't have friends. It can also be feeling like disconnected or alienated from something bigger than yourself, whether that's community or something higher. So we know that if you look at, like, how do people find that feeling of connection and belonging, movement is baked into it, whether we are celebrating, whether it's through teamwork, like competition, like you see in team sports, whether it's through engaging in physical labor together, whether it is literally traveling together, like through walking and through running or marching. That movement is often how people come together to try to strengthen their bonds. Somehow human beings are built to feel like we are tied together when we move together. And so, you know, it's basic to our human psychology as well. So you got the neurochemistry and you've got this idea that, like, I know I belong because I was able to help you, you know, lift something heavy. I spotted you. And then you had the experience of, she's got me. And so you felt like someone was looking after you. It's so basic. And yet it can have very profound effects.
And also just definitely baked into, like, our evolution.
Yeah, yeah.
Of being on the planes together. My modern day way of trying to recreate that and also work with the factors that make it difficult for friends to sometimes meet up is that I've coined the term amongst my friend group of an opt-out event. It's an event on the calendar that's a reoccurring event. And I have one with a group of guys. We've been doing it for the last 4 years. We do about 30 weeks in the year out of 52. We call it Man Morning Thursday. Mm-hmm. And every Thursday, we meet at 7 a.m. in the morning. And we meet at usually Will Rogers here in Santa Monica, or we'll meet at the beach over here in Santa Monica or Venice. And we start on time at 7 a.m. And there's usually about 5 to 8 of us. We go on a walk and we talk about what we're excited about. But more importantly, we talk about stuff that isn't working out. And we just all kind of walk and we go around the group and share. But the key is we're doing it while moving.
Yes. Yes. There are studies showing that the conversations people have while walking are qualitatively different, that people disclose more freely, that they are able to take a broader perspective on their problems. It is, again, this is something basic to how our minds work, how our brains work. When we're physically active, our default state shifts. This is something you've probably talked about on your show, you know, the default state of the mind that is so often critical, worrying, you know, it's often not our friend. And we know that walking is actually one of the easiest ways to disrupt our usual default state so that we can take a new perspective on things, so that we're less sort of tight in our usual habits of the mind. And so, you know, whether you're walking or running or whatever it is you might be doing with someone, like, this is, you have discovered a very good thing.
So let's go personal for a second. For you in your life, you've talked about your passion for exercise and aerobics and jazzercise. Uh-huh. But how do you combine in your own life movement and community? How does it show up for you?
I am so privileged to teach group movement classes. So I've been teaching primarily yoga and dance for about 20 years, almost 20 years now. And, you know, it's the most amazing thing to be able to lead group exercise. I know how meaningful it can be for participants, but it's hard to explain. But one of the things I write about in the book is how moving in synchrony with other people allows you to see the good in other people. So, you know, if you and I were to do some mirror exercise and, you know, we move our arms at the same time, that seems to, it just turns on some human instinct to trust one another and see the good in one another. And so when you teach group exercise, you know, imagine you're in a room with 20 or 30 or 50 people, and every person in that room is looking at you and mirroring your movements, whether you're leading them through a sun salutation or leading them in a dance routine. And so what happened to me is when I started teaching group movement, suddenly I felt like people were seeing a different version of me. You know, growing up, I had this sense, not that I was a horrible human being, but I certainly would never have assumed that other people would automatically see me as a good person or like me. That was not my assumption. My assumption would have been, you know, there's something wrong with me. If people saw the real me, they maybe wouldn't like me. And to be in my early 20s and having rooms full of people, because they're synchronizing their bodies with me, project onto me the best possible version of myself. It changed the way I sensed myself. It literally changed the person I became, because now for sometimes hours a day, I was in a space where people were happy to see me. They saw the good in me just because I was leading them in synchronized movement. And that is like the most powerful therapy. I'm sure that there are going to be some people watching or listening to this who teach movement, and they will know what I'm talking about. There's like a therapy that happens for the person who is teaching. And so I continue to teach dance and exercise. I teach 6 classes a week. And it's the greatest joy, because again, it's a gift you're giving to others, but the gift you get back, having that place where you belong, and there's just something about the role that is, it's unlike anything else I experience in my professional or personal life. And
if somebody's not the teacher, can they still tap into some of those same
benefits? Of course. So many of my students will talk about how they feel seen and they feel connected to the people that they move with. And there's so many stories. It's so funny. When I started writing this book, I kept getting messages on social media like, are you writing about the community aspect? Because when people heard me say, oh, I'm talking about the mental health benefits of exercise, and people probably expected me to talk like about go for a run, it'll, you know, be good for your depression. And people were like, you are talking about community, right? Because of this community that I found at Orange Theory or CrossFit or wherever it is. And I'm like, yeah, I am writing about it. It was the number one theme that came up. People who do marathon running or ultra marathon running, people who row, whatever the form of movement was, powerlifting. When I would talk to people about it and like, what is your joy and how has it had a positive effect on your life? I think like 100% people wanted to talk about the community aspect. So, you know, the teacher gets a certain special version of it that's really amazing. But the participant who's just in a community, whether it's a walking group, a running group, whether you're training in a gym together, whatever it is, everyone gets that sense of belonging. Everyone gets to cooperate and share in that. And I'm not saying that you have to. Like, for some people, movement, they really need time by themselves. And often those are the same people who love exercising outdoors. But if you're someone who craves a community and you want to experience more belonging, you should know that movement is like the most powerful biological mechanism for getting that going.
There's a friend of mine, Lewis Howes, he has a podcast, The School of Greatness. And he says, you know, especially when it comes to making friends from scratch, and if you feel like the friendships that you have are not the friends that are going to maybe take you to the next level or the most supportive at this place that you're in life, or maybe you just moved, you got to go to where people grow.
Yes.
And there's something powerful about going to a fitness class, to going to something where people are moving together, even if it's salsa, which is another great way of moving, is that there's often people that are there that are going to grow, and you're going to form new bonds with those individuals.
Yeah. I mean, I've actually heard him say that, and I thought it was brilliant when he said that. And what's great about movement communities is often everyone's on their own trajectory. And as soon as you start showing up, there are people who are interested in supporting and helping you grow. but very quickly you become someone who can also help other people in their journey. I read this one dissertation. It's like hundreds of pages interviewing middle-aged women and older women who had started running in midlife or later. And the researcher wanted to know, how did you know when you were a runner? Like, when did that become part of your identity? And the most common response was the first time someone asked them for advice, like on socks or anything. And they had that opportunity to give some advice or wisdom or support to someone else. And that's when it really became a part of their identity. And so, you know, this is true anywhere where people are growing, but often in movement communities, the great thing is you get to be on the receiving and giving end of support. And we know that that is so crucial for mental health. It's really not balanced for your mental health to always be the helper or to always be the recipient of other people's help. Like, you really need both. And movement communities are a great way to be able to do that.
You talk about running, and one of the things you talk about inside the book is how the runner's high that many people have heard of is not exclusive to running.
Oh, no. So I ended up calling it a persistence high because it's this idea that it's an adaptation of your brain that helped humans hundreds of thousands of years ago persist in their pursuit of food, whether they were foraging or scavenging or hunting, that the brain found a way to basically, you know, hijack the reward system to make physical labor rewarding, and primarily through the endocannabinoid system, which is an interesting class of neurochemicals. It is what cannabis mimics, but I find myself having to keep telling people, cannabis doesn't do exactly the same thing as a runner's high. Like, there are some important differences, but there's some similarities too.
And the whole CBD movement and everything
that. So there's some overlaps, but the way that the endocannabinoid system gets harnessed when you are physically active, endocannabinoids basically amp up anything in your brain that helps you feel good. So it enhances the effects of endorphins. It enhances the effect of dopamine. It enhances the effect of oxytocin, which helps us bond and also feel more optimistic and brave. So endocannabinoids are basically like amping up all the good stuff in your brain, pleasure, meaning, optimism, hope, and also at the same time dampening down things like anxiety, fear, stress, anger. So endocannabinoids is an amazing system for the brain to have been like, let's just make people feel good and hopeful and dial down the physical pain and dial down the anxiety, because this will help keep people engaged while they get the nourishment that they and their family need. And that's the runner's high. But it really is just a persistence high that you need to do something where you're in a continuous state of movement. And studies suggest probably 20 minutes and not super intense. I mean, you can get other highs from super intense exercise. It's not like you won't feel good. But if you just want the basic runner's high or exercise high, moderate intensity, 20 minutes, you can get that doing almost anything.
And there's this feeling that kicks in. I know I've definitely felt it. I go to a CrossFit-like type gym, shout out to 34 North here in Santa Monica, and my trainer's Tanner, and there's these group classes that are there, and there's this feeling of like, you actually feel good, you want to keep on going, even though it's a very tough activity.
Yeah.
And that's a nice feeling to have.
Yeah.
I want to go back to your personal story again, and you were talking about your mom.
Mm-hmm.
And how she would buy these exercise tapes and want to do it and could never kind of get into that role. Now that there's been this modern fitness craze in a great way, there's a lot of people that, let's just say, if I had to draw an age where I think it started really kind of coming in, let's say there's a lot of people that are, you know, in their mid 40s and below that have kind of been a part of that craze, just time wise. And they want to help their parents because they've seen the benefits that happen, how it increases mobility. And when we look at actually the reasons that people die, like hip fractures are really high and other stuff. For those that are listening that want to support their parents or anybody that's older than them to step into this, that often sometimes there's so much stigma or so many failed attempts, what would you recommend for those
individuals? Okay, so first of all, if you live anywhere near them, okay, so the way to get people to enjoy movement is you have to pair movement with things they already enjoy. And if you are around and you can do it with them, A+. Like, for many parents, older parents, to get to spend time with you, to go for that walk, or to find a class that you think will be physically accessible to your parent or your loved one. I mean, this goes also for spouses and friends, not only parents. And to make spending quality time with you, in which you make sure that you go into it wanting to connect, not to like micromanage their physical experience.
You're
of
not
the
doing
workout.
It right. You need to go faster. Yeah, this, right? That, don't, whatever don't, it is.
Like to do it with them is going to be an obvious first step if that is physically possible. Another thing is to ask people, was there ever a time in your life when movement was important to you? Or was there an activity that you enjoyed? I was actually just talking with my mom about this. So she read the book this week and she started talking about how she remembers how much she loved being in water. And that maybe that was something that she should go back to, because she heard all, read all these stories in the book about people later in life coming to movement and suddenly rediscovering the joy of it. So that can be another way in. Did you used to love to dance? Did you used to love sports? And now there's a version available to almost anyone at any age or any physical ability. You can find community classes, you can find support groups, you can find YouTube videos. And the other thing I would say is to not, you introduce this as almost like a way to avoid hip fractures, right? And as much as that is true, of course, people live longer, exercise can help prevent cancer or cancer recurrence. I mean, anything good that for your physical health, exercise seems to help with it. And yet talking about that does not seem to help people want to move. It really is about focusing on what people love. And so if you can help people think about what they love and what joy they want more of, that often that will be a way for people to figure out for themselves what that next form of movement could be for them.
I want to pivot. You gave a TED Talk on stress, and there's a connection here. You talk about inside of that TED Talk and in other places too, that the new research around stress suggests that it may only be bad for you if you believe it to be the case.
Yeah, and though, let me put a reframe on that. That's so funny. That was the way that my TED Talk was described, or even worse, the takeaway was, if you believe stress will kill you, it will. Okay, so let me do the reframe that actually I think is more helpful for people.
Okay, do it.
That if you take a more positive, balanced view of stress, it allows you to access stress strengths that are built into our human nature, that it is possible to be good at stress in a way that can prevent some of what we think of as the inevitable harmful consequences of stress. So it's not so much like I don't want to terrorize people into thinking, if you believe stress will kill you, it will. If you think stress is bad, it is bad. And if you're experiencing negative effects of stress, it's your fault because you're thinking wrong. That's not exactly what I mean. What I'm trying to teach people is that the human brain and body has a whole stress response repertoire. It is not the case that human beings are incapable of dealing with stress. Life is stressful. Hans Selye defined stress as what happens in your brain and body whenever you need to adapt or respond to life. Life is always stressful. And, evolution did not stick us with some stress response system that will only ever make us sick and miserable and, the worst version of ourselves. So the research suggests is when you accept that life is stressful and you believe that your brain and body have capacities to deal with stress in ways that are healthy, skillful, and allow you to experience meaning and joy and connection, it's almost like a good placebo effect. It actually allows you to access these biological resources so that your stress response is healthier, so that your choices in moments of stress are more skillful. And ultimately, the thing that gets a lot of attention is you end up with studies saying you're going to be more likely to be alive in a decade or less likely to experience heart disease if your life is very stressful.
And the connection to the book now and the joy of movement is that exercise is supposed to be a little stressful for your body. And when we embrace that stress and have it regularly, it seems to be that it makes it easier to handle the other stressors that we can't necessarily control that are around us that are part of modern day living.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't even write about this in the book, but one of the things I learned very early on, so my early scientific research was looking at how the mind and the body respond to things like anger and stress. And one of the first things I learned from the research is that exercise changes your default physiological response to stress so that you are more likely to have a challenge response to everyday stress rather than a fight or flight response. And in my TED talk, if people have seen that, I talk about how thinking about stress differently can help you have a challenge response. But it turns out that people who engage in cardiovascular exercise, because of the way that that teaches the brain and the nervous system to function in a healthy way during stress, exercise as stress, it's more likely to become your default response to stress. So now when you're about to have a conversation that makes you nervous, you'll have a challenge response that will help you connect and be your best self rather than a fight or flight response or to become paralyzed or, you know, whatever the stressor is. And there are so many examples like that where exercise teaches us how to be better at stress.
There's the researcher and now soon author, he's an author, BJ Fogg, are you familiar with him? He's at Stanford.
Tiny Habits.
Tiny Habits.
Also out now.
It's out now.
Brand new book.
He's going to be coming on the podcast soon.
Excellent.
Met him a few years ago, and one of the things that sort of central to his thesis of Tiny Habits, took a great, you know, behavior design workshop that he hosts at his house up there in the Bay Area, is that one of the best ways to make significant leaps and bounds in our life is to take smaller, joyful habits and stack them along with things that are already a habit in our life. I would love to hear what you think about that. And also how there's a lot of individuals that I know that are listening to this podcast and well-meaning, and I want them to have any goal that they want to have. When it comes back to where we started the conversation on New Year's resolutions, other stuff, sometimes we set such lofty, big, big goals, which are beautiful. And then people feel like they're disappointed because they have not been able to make progress in that. When it comes to movement, whether it's through the lens of tiny habits, whether it's through your own lens, a mix of all the in between, how could we reframe that big lofty goal that I'm going to lose 30 pounds or do X, Y, or Z if that hasn't worked for somebody in the past, and actually tap into the joy of movement so that we're much more likely to get there eventually?
Yeah. Well, so if you do want to set a big goal, can I suggest that you set a stretch goal that actually involves movement rather than weight loss? So that would be one of my first suggestions. Because many people actually are motivated by big goals. And in the book, I talk a lot about the psychological benefits of moving toward something that, so a stretch goal is something that you aren't sure it's possible. You're so not sure it's possible that you're not even like, it doesn't necessarily matter if you accomplish it or not. It's an idea in your head that intrigues you. Like, could I run a half marathon? Could I ever do a headstand away from the wall? Could I ever participate in an obstacle course race like Tough Mudder? Maybe you've seen someone do it or you've heard about it and the idea appeals to you. Could I, you know, if I didn't learn how to swim as a child, would it be possible to learn how to swim now? And when you have this stretch goal that is connected to a version of yourself that intrigues you, there's something about that movement accomplishment that inspires you, that would make you imagine that other things are possible in your life too. That's actually often a very motivating goal. And it's one that will allow you to put yourself into a place where you start to take the small steps that move you in that direction, taking a class, you know, signing up for instruction, whatever it is. And I think that, you know, I'm a big believer in attaching things to meaning. So if you're starting small is the right thing to do for most people for behavior change, but the why matters. And BJ Fogg talks about this too. Like, you need to have a real why. And so often for many people, the joy of movement is to imagine what that big goal could be, because it would say something about who they are. It would be almost like a self-defining moment. And if you can imagine a self-defining moment that's related to movement itself, that's not about, I want to lose a certain number of pounds or look a certain way or spend a certain amount of time every day exercising because I think that's what's required or what's good for me, but that you're the self-defining moment of what is it going to feel like to cross a finish line and have my kid at the finish line high-five me. That's the kind of big goal to set. And then you just do what you can when you can, and you look for ways to pair it with things that are already joyful. BJ Fogg also talks a lot about celebration and the importance of celebrating your wins. And what's so great is, like, you know, if you're applying that strategy to some forms of behavior change, like saving money, it's hard to get other people to celebrate it with you. But the great thing about movement and movement communities is people are so excited to celebrate with you. The first time you manage to do a push-up on your toes instead of your knees, people will be there to high-five you.
A lot of celebration.
So in many ways, get yourself into the right environment. Remember how important it is to celebrate every milestone. You get to experience the sympathetic joy of doing that for other people too. Like, there's a lot of ways to apply his insights in behavior change. In some ways, it's easier with movement because of how movement is so core to who we are as human beings. Mm. It is going to be easier to experience that basic process, particularly if you put yourself into communities of support. If you're doing it all on your own, it's a little bit of a heavier lift.
For someone like yourself who's teaching classes regularly and has movement pretty incorporated into their life, what are some of your goals when it comes to the area of movement?
So I will say right now, one of my biggest goals is, this may be disappointing, I don't know, but I am trying to be more intentional about creating space in my classes for people to connect, not with me, but with one another. So how do I time the playlists, the starting times, create an environment before and after class where people are connecting with one another? And that came from the research in this book. I was like, wow, this is such a great opportunity. How can I design that into my class experiences so it's less likely that people run in late and rush off or whatever? In terms of my own movement practice, I will tell you I did a Peloton workout for the first time ever this morning. So I like trying new things. And in doing publicity for this book, I cannot tell you how many interviewers told me either during the interview or afterward that Peloton is the form of movement. This is not I'm not sponsored by Peloton. This is my first workout ever. That was the thing that for them broke it open. Wow. And for many different reasons. Some people love the feeling of it being social. Some people love that a lot of people love the music. A lot of people love just the idea of it. A lot of people love the intensity that afterwards they feel different about themselves.
Specifically Peloton, not like SoulCycle, not anything.
Well, they have, maybe it all works, but people have been saying Peloton.
Okay, got it.
So I did the workout this morning and it was amazing. I loved it. My hotel room had a bike. And so I was thinking, yeah, I could use this in my life. I like the feeling of how hard it was to push the pedals and to have the instructor talk to me about the psychology of what it means to be able to do that. So, you know, who knows? I might end up with a Peloton bike because of that class was so good. But I think that's something that I'm interested in finding forms of movement where you sense the metaphor of the movement while you're doing it. I found that through yoga first. It was actually the first time I felt that. And for many years, a very big metaphor for me was like doing yoga poses that scared me, like going upside down or going backward. And it was a really useful metaphor in many ways. And so I encourage people to think about that too. Is there a movement that for you, when you're doing it, you sense that it's working at the surface level of, yes, I'm putting one foot in front of the other. And also the metaphor, I'm putting one foot in front of the other, that many movement forms will have that metaphorical power to them. And so I'm always continuing to chase that.
After you've had movement incorporated into your life, and I think this is a super beneficial for somebody who doesn't have it incorporated. If I just speak to my own personal story, I didn't get serious about movement. I would go surfing occasionally. I'd go on hikes. I've been doing this hike with my group of friends, but it wasn't until about 2.5 years ago that I really started incorporating movement on a regular basis. And for me, after trying a lot of different stuff, that was working with a private trainer one-on-one. That really hit the spot for me.
Why?
I think there's two reasons. And I think this goes back because so much of movement is tied into like insecurities and thoughts that are there. So here's the actual real reason. Growing up, I grew up in the Indian community and I was vegetarian, right? My parents said you could be however you want to be, but we're vegetarian for these reasons. And so I was vegetarian. And even though I was active and I played sports, I played soccer, I was on varsity tennis and other things like that, when I actually started to notice that I wanted to like work out in high school, end of high school, because I was also vegetarian, other stuff, I didn't really feel like I was getting the gains in my body from not having a lot of protein of seeing the transformation. At that time, I equated transformation in my body for the main reason for exercise. Mm-hmm. And then getting ready for the game was more like the fun stuff, right? For tennis. So then for a long time, I did not go and seek out exercise. I would do a little game of tennis here and there, a little game of pickup soccer, only the fun stuff that was there. So I avoided the gym, but anytime I would go, I would feel good, but I wouldn't keep it up for those reasons and the insecurities of feeling like I'm not making enough progress. And then a couple years ago, and as my diet has evolved and changed over the years, I got back into it, addressed those insecurities and said, okay, they're not serving me anymore. And immediately started seeing shifts in my body and felt excited, felt that momentum, felt a good rhythm of it. And it wasn't just at a gym. It was a lot of mobility. It was a lot of fun things. It was like gymnastics incorporated and other aspects. It just clicked at the time. And shout out to my dear friend, Corey, who now works in my company, who was the trainer that I worked with. So that became a shift. And then I started noticing the benefits for my brain health more than actually the physical changes in my body. Again, getting out of that, I didn't need to lose any weight at all. But instead of thinking about putting on muscle or whatever it might be, I saw how much better of a decision maker I was in the day. That it actually helped me be more resilient in running all the different companies and my 60 employees that I have that are working on all sorts of different projects. I felt so much stronger in my decision making and in my level of thinking. So that's been my journey with it. And so the reason I got into this and the point that I wanted to share is I can identify with the person who didn't have movement regularly in their life. And for yourself, I think that sometimes we see the power of something when we think about the opposite happening. So have you ever been through a week or two or three that you have not had movement in your life? And what are the first signs you see, kind of like an early sign of a cold or this or that? What are the first signs you see in the other areas of your life where you know that you're missing out in movement?
Yeah, it's there have only been there are two periods of my life where I was not as active as I usually am. Both were related to loss, where in both cases, losing a loved one, getting sick, and then getting depressed in a way that, you know, I mentioned earlier, like you don't want to move, you can't move. And during one of those periods, I was actually still teaching movement, but I was mostly teaching yoga classes and functional movement classes for people with serious chronic pain or other movement challenges. So in both of those classes, you can talk a lot without actually doing the movement yourself. And the other period of time, it was actually one of the few periods of my life when I wasn't able to maintain my weekly group fitness classes. So I was able to like not move as much. And so it's not that what happened is like life got busy and I didn't exercise and then I went into withdrawal, which is what you actually will see in the research that, you know, people who love to move and are dependent on it for their mental health or their mood, they will show signs of withdrawal and like after one missed workout, because movement is such a great regulator of our mood and our stress. But for me, it was the loss was I couldn't access the joy of movement. I could put on, you know, the same music and try to dance to it. And my brain was like, okay, but we're not gonna give you an endorphin rush, even though this is one of your favorite songs and you love to dance to it. And so, you know, I don't have a story about realizing how important movement was, but my experience was having to move through that. You know, and I remember that one period where I worked my way up to doing, there was a Zumba warm-up that I had that was like 9 minutes long. And in the beginning, I just could not like get past the first 3 minutes before being like, I can't do this. And then getting through and doing that same warm-up for like weeks. And then trying to get back into doing a kickboxing workout and feeling like, why is this not working? And then it working. It's that idea that I mentioned where, so I know it from direct experience as well as the science. Sometimes you have to keep going because you know how good it is for you. And even if it doesn't feel like you think it should feel.
And then eventually, in most cases, it'll kick in.
Yeah, yeah.
And those benefits will
come. And that it, whatever the sort of the natural healing process is emotionally, and this is true for healing from anything, that exercise seems to enhance the plasticity of your brain in terms of healing from anything, trauma, stroke, psychological trauma, social trauma, loss, depression, addiction. Exercise is enhancing plasticity. It'll enhance the changes that happen in therapy. So if you know that exercise facilitates positive adaptation, like whatever you're experiencing now, again, you have to take a leap of faith sometimes, but that really is like an essential function of exercise, is to help your brain get better from wherever it is now.
So I didn't know this, but you shared before the interview got started about your work in the space of research at Stanford and Dr. Doty and the whole team over there in the School of Compassion. What's it called?
It's called the Center for CCARE, Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education.
Got it.
It's a mouthful, lot.
But yeah. It's great. They're doing incredible work, including hosting the Dalai Lama, many other individuals, and putting out incredible information and research. What role, you know, a lot of times people say that exercise is my meditation, right? We'd love to hear your thoughts on that. And also, what role does meditation play in your life? Yeah. Are you just as regular with meditation as you are with movement?
But it plays a very different role. Exercise is how I experience what are often referred to as the high activation positive states. So for me, that includes courage and joy. If I want to, these are not my natural default emotional states are like dread and anxiety. That's my temperament from birth. So when I want to experience feeling really alive and vital in a positive way, movement does that for me. Meditation does not do that for me. Meditation allows me to access wisdom and perspective and train my mind. And my favorite meditations are Citta Bhavana meditations that are really the idea that you're going to lead your mind in a certain direction through contemplation and focus to develop the personal qualities that you want to be able to share with the world. So my work at CCARE was helping to design a program specifically to help people strengthen compassion and empathy and loving kindness. And those are the types of meditations that have been most important for me because you are teaching your mind how to enter a place of feeling common humanity, of feeling like you are willing to approach suffering rather than give in to the desire to escape suffering and protect yourself. So that the role that meditation plays in my life and the practices that I do on a daily basis are around that. My favorite meditation is Tonglen, which is where you become aware of suffering in some way in the world, in another person, and you imagine breathing it in and allowing it to be transformed through your connection to compassion itself. Something not like little Kelly, like I have to turn this suffering into hope, but the sense of that you can connect in your heart and mind to the idea of compassion, the ideal of compassion, a compassionate energy that is bigger than you and part of our human capacity to relieve suffering in the world. And you imagine then breathing out hope and strength and love. That's my favorite meditation. For people who say that exercise is their meditation, I think the thing that they are referring to most often is actually legitimate. Research suggesting that exercise quiets the default state of the mind in a way that the only other thing that seems to do it is meditation, mindfulness particularly, or mantra meditation. Meditation techniques where you learn to focus the mind and quiet the mind. For many people, they can actually experience it much more quickly and with less frustration through movement. So I think that a lot of times when people start training in meditation, all they experience is they meet their default mind. And it's like, meditation makes me angry. Meditation makes me anxious. Meditation, you know, makes me crazy because they're sitting with their mind. And it takes a long time to develop often the skills to really experience peace of mind in meditation rather than just, oh, this is what my mind is. So I'm all for using exercise as a way to quiet the mind and have a different relationship. I'm also all for learning how to meet your mind through meditation. I think it's a different skill you're learning. But it's no joke when people say they experience something like meditation and movement.
If you could create a modern day gym, in whatever, I mean, you have an empty box, and you can create any kind of experience inside of there. You have 1 hour with people, or you could have multiple sorts of things going on, and you're in charge of the experience. You're in charge of the experience design, and you have unlimited funds that are there. What does...
From your lips to investors' ears. Can I tell you, my dream in life would be to be able to do that, but I'm not a business person. I could never run a business. If there's anyone, by the way, who wants to do this and just let me do the design part and teach, like, that would be my dream come true.
You heard it. There's folks that are out there listening. Entrepreneurs, investors, other individuals.
So I don't have to hire or manage anybody.
What does that experience look like? Based on your experiences, your teaching, the research that you've seen out there, what does Dr. Kelly's gym look like? And I use gym in an open
And I have
term.
A name for it. We are going to be called the Joy Collective, because my favorite form of movement is collective joy. Now, so, and by the way, I don't know that this is the ideal for everyone. My ideal movement space would be one that amplifies the two main forms of collective joy that humans experience. One is moving together in meaningful or celebratory ways to music. So we would have dance classes. And if you were doing strength training, there would be a playlist involved. And maybe there would be a cycling studio that involves a lip syncing for your life component. That, like, there is going to be music involved in moving our bodies. And the other form of collective joy that is so key to human experience is the sense of being able to contribute to a community that you care about. And I don't know what exactly that would look like. I've always had this dream of a movement space where people also are engaged in activism and volunteer work and giving back to their communities. And one of the programs I write about in the book is called Good Gym. And they figured this out, the way that works for a lot of people in the UK, where people join like a running club in their neighborhood. They meet at one place in their neighborhood. They run for a couple of miles to another place in their neighborhood where they do a community service project.
Wow.
And then they run back to where they started. And often they'll have drinks or dinner afterward and continue to connect. And the people who do this, they really form such tight bonds, not only with the other runners, but their sense that, like, I belong in my community. They go out their doors and they're like, I planted that plant. Mm. Or, you know, I helped, you know, contribute to that community center. So my ideal movement experience would have something like that. And I don't know what form it would take, but the collective joy of feeling like my participation in this movement community is also allowing me to be the best version of myself and give back. While also lip syncing for your life.
Yes. Yeah. What would be the first song in that playlist?
Oh my gosh.
Right, one of the songs.
I know,
one of the songs.
I know. It's too much. One of my favorite songs to dance to is Move Your Body by Sia. And in part because, so I am the kind of person where I'll watch the videos on YouTube. And that video by Sia, Move Your Body, I feel like it is just an ode to the joy of being who you are and moving in any way that brings you pleasure. And so now when I hear that song, I can't help but feel that feeling. So we'll go with that.
All right.
But man, I have Spotify playlists. If people really want to know the songs that I use in my classes,
they can follow you.
They can find me on Spotify. I post playlists for all my classes.
That's incredible.
Because when you move to music, it becomes motivating and meaningful. And then you listen to that song, you know, the song that you lifted weights to or that you ran to or that you danced to. You can access the feelings you had about yourself when you listen to that song.
It puts you back in that state. Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to hear the playlist, it's in the show notes.
Okay,
we'll grab the link from you. And the book is out January 6th. It's already out there.
It's out now.
It's out now. Pre-order it. You can get it. The Joy of Movement. Kelly, thank you for coming on the Broken Brain podcast and teaching us about the power of incorporating joy into it and how, most importantly, I mean, these ideas have been out there, but there's so much research that's now come to the forefront and you've weaved it in all together in such a beautiful way. And sometimes that is the thing that connects the
dots.
We
need language for it. I hope now hope molecules will become part of our vocabulary.
Hope molecules for sure. So the book is out there. You can find it at your website, which is also in the show notes, yourfirstnamelastname.com. And are you active on social media? Can people find you there?
Yes, I'm loving Instagram these days. So on Instagram and Spotify, I'm Kelly Marie McGonigal.
Fantastic. And we'll link to both of those as well. Kelly, I'm glad this worked out. Big thanks to our friend and connector, Sean from the Model Health Show, for making this interview happen. And it's an honor to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search there, find a provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.